Astroid goals.
That's what we like to do on this show. Find the comedy gold.
Astroid goals.
I just like
non-fungible as a word.
It is a good word.
It's a wonderful, it just has a good mouthfeel.
La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the noon hour of... I keep doing that, the noon hour. We're at 11 now. We're on 10 to 12. No longer have a noon hour. Only have an 11 o'clock hour. And it's starting right now. And I'm very excited to have our guest for the next half hour. He's a returning champion, here to talk about science of reading versus whole language versus balanced, because it's a recurring theme. And there's a new update as far as where we're at in Wisconsin trying to address our literacy rates, because last week, new legislation was introduced as far as trying to have an overhaul of how we teach reading in Wisconsin. And I'm so excited to talk to you about it. Alan Borsick is back. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School. And he still frequently writes about education in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. How are you doing, Alan?
I am good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm also good. You know, it's Monday. We're still swapping times and trying to figure out when we're actually on air. But and so I guess let's, before we dive into what this new legislation proposal says, let's go back, and we've talked about this on the show before, but for people who have not or are not familiar with the debate over the science of reading versus balanced literacy versus whole language, kind of refresh everyone on what this debate is.
Well, I think the crew on the Mayflower in 1607 was split over how to teach kids to read. And,
you don't think they had bigger problems back then?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. How do you spell thou? any case, the dispute goes back many, many years. Someone recently gave me some history. It started in 1947.
Oh, wow.
The reading wars between phonics and what was then known as whole language. I was writing about this in the 1990s and in the early 2000s. It may seem like a simple issue, and in some ways everybody agrees on certain things. Everybody wants kids to learn how to read. Everyone thinks reading's important. But this becomes extremely, they are definitely two different approaches, and it becomes extremely divisive. I mean, you have heated battles over this that are reminiscent of a lot of other heated battles we got going on in the world. One school, the more classic school, what they were teaching to the kids on the Mayflower probably was that you got a word, it's got letters, you sound them out, you put them together. I'm way oversimplifying it. There's a whole science of brain processing on this. And so sounding out the letters is the key to learning how to read. In a more mid-20th to late 20th century approach, kids, the idea was kids would learn to read by immersing themselves in it, recognizing words as a whole, context, pictures, certain key letters. But that sense of sounding out letters was much downplayed. The one school was, the critics of phonics said that it's too mechanical and kids don't learn how to actually understand what they're reading or love reading. And the critics of whole language said, kids just aren't, too many kids, not all, are not learning to read well. And if you can't sound out a word, you really can't be a successful reader. So very passionate debate. It sort of subsided 15 or 17 or 18 years ago when this balanced literacy emerged. But reading scores have not improved nationwide. They haven't improved in Milwaukee. They haven't improved in Wisconsin as a whole. In fact, they got worse during the pandemic. And now there's a huge surge of advocacy for the more phonics-based approach saying, we got to do something about reading scores, and you got to do it by focusing on sounding out a word. So this is on the brink of becoming the official law of the state of Wisconsin. almost 30 states have already passed laws or established state policies promoting mm-hmm. a more phonics-based approach. So it's a big, hot issue nationwide and now in Wisconsin.
And it's come here. And so
yep.
as of last week, Republicans unveiled a plan to revamp how children will learn to read. And so what does that bill look like? And do you think, I guess, because it's sponsored by Republicans, and so in our environment, I guess, well, first question, we'll start there, and then I'll ask my follow-up, more political question. What's in the bill?
What's in the bill? It would require the what's called the science of reading approach, and it doesn't, the science of reading certainly involves more than phonics, but it's phonics heavy. It's explicit and scripted in many cases. It's very structured, starting with kindergarten, especially first and second grade. And if you walked into a classroom that's doing a really good job of science of reading and walked into a classroom that's doing a really good job more whole language, you would really know the difference. You
okay.
would just tell. In any case, this bill would require science of reading approaches in every school in Wisconsin, including private and charter schools. It would virtually ban the balanced literacy approach, and especially what's called three Q-ing, which is a whole a description of how to teach kids to read based on cues of what's going on around them,
like pictures, context clues and letters, stuff,
context, and so on. If anyone's really interested in this, I don't want to encourage your competition, but there's a set of podcasts that came out, I believe, starting in October called Sold a Story by a APM, American Public Media journalist named Emily Hanford,
mm-hmm.
that just takes apart three Q-ing and some of the longtime heroes of reading. It's really interesting listening, and it's had enormous impact nationwide. I don't know of any education project that's ever had the impact that those podcasts have had.
You know, it's so funny. Since the first time, I think it's the third, maybe fourth time you've been on the show, and we've always talked about reading, and I've gotten super interested in it from our conversations, but how much it's come up organically in other conversations with my friends outside of work at all, entirely, including my cousin and who has two girls who are elementary school and middle school in Minnesota. And she listened to that whole podcast, right? Because this is happening in Minnesota. Like, this is happening all over the place as far as, like, what's happening with kids and reading. And I've gotten super interested in it. So I haven't listened to that podcast yet, but I will link it for today because I've heard nothing but good things about it as far as trying to actually understand the issue. And so with this new bill, like you said, it would be public schools, private schools, charter schools. Do you think this is something that Tony Evers would sign?
The partisanship on this is so interesting because increasingly it's definitely Republicans who put the bill up last week, and the press conference was all Republicans. They had hoped they'd get one or two Democrats, but that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of negotiating going on between the governor and some of the people on the Republican side pushing this, and particularly between the Republicans and the Department of Public Instruction. And they agree on a lot. They agree on almost the entire bill. DPI apparently is willing to sign on to the entire bill, except for one particularly controversial aspect of it, which could blow up the whole deal. It's really hard to tell what's going to happen. Last week, I thought this was not going to happen, and then clearly it heated up. And that question is, what do you do with a kid who isn't doing well in reading by the end of third grade, setting aside kids with special ed needs or English language learners? You know, they would be in a different category.
Yeah.
But your typical kid who isn't doing well, I've had grandchildren who are in that category. Do you hold them back? Do you give them special treatment? I mean, extra programming, summer school, tutoring, you name it. Or do you just pass them forward? In principle, it sounds like a really good thing. You say a kid really shouldn't go to fourth grade until they're ready to read, because that's a one thing that everyone in education agrees on, is being able to read by the end of third grade is important. On the other hand, it sounds good. There's a lot of research that suggests it just doesn't work, though, that holding kids back is not only unsuccessful, it's actually counterproductive.
Really?
You know, a kid who didn't do well in third grade isn't likely to do much better by repeating third grade. And especially if they're getting older and their friends have moved forward, and just socially, it's pretty disastrous for a lot of kids. On the other hand, if it's done really well, like getting the kid the help they need, that they may need way more individualized attention, you name it, then it can be positive. Mississippi, which is the national model of implementation of the science of reading, says that third grade retention has been handled quite successfully there. But a lot of places have had really bad experiences. The DPI is very opposed to it because they think it'll be harmful to kids. The governor has not expressed himself yet.
Okay.
It's a tough issue to compromise because to some degree you either have third grade retention or you don't. The provision that's in there now wouldn't implement it until 5 years from now. It wouldn't really affect kids until 2028. Nonetheless, it's in there, and that could be a deal breaker. It's really hard to tell.
That's super interesting, because I had read that part as far as, and I didn't know the studies or the science behind whether or not holding kids back works. And it sounds like it's inconclusive.
It works if it's done really well, and it's done really well fairly rarely. I mean, that's true of so much in education and many other things. If it was done well, it was a different story than if it's done poorly.
Absolutely.
And just kind of mediocrely.
Well, we have to take a break right now, but when we come back, I want to talk about Cudahy, because Cudahy has been doing this. You've been writing on Cudahy doing the science of reading and kind of what success they've seen that is proven versus anecdotal. So we will talk about that when we come back. Our guest is Alan Borsick, who is a senior fellow at Marquette Law School and longtime journalist on education issues. If you have any questions and want to know more about reading, 844-967-2789. We'll be back right after the break. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Out to school, the teacher is teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. You study them hard.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry, and we are talking to Alan Borsick, who is a senior fellow at Marquette Law School and frequently still writes about education for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he worked for a very long time. But actually, Alan, I wanted to tell you a story. I wanted to tell you a story quickly, because in learning more about the reading debates that have been happening, I asked my mom, because I think the first time you came on, I was like, I don't remember how I learned how to read. And I asked her, and because I started elementary school in the 90s, she remembers specifically she had friends who took their kids out of public school in Madison because of this change. And she said, oh, yeah, I totally remember, like, Mary and Christy, like, they took their kids out and they put them in Queen of Peace, which was the parochial school I went to, because Queen of Peace was still going to teach phonics.
Went to Queen of Peace?
Yeah, I went to Queen of Peace, yeah.
My neighbors went to Queen of Peace, okay.
Shout out QP. But it was so funny how distinctly she remembered that switch in the 90s and how controversial it was then, and we're still dealing with it now. And so you recently wrote about Cudahy making this decision as a school district to make the switch. And so what kind of propelled them to do it, and how has it been working there?
Really interesting question. Cudahy is a changing community. It's a classic white, blue collar working community that's become much more diverse, still fairly much a working class community. But the diversity is dramatically different than, say, 25 years ago. They were not satisfied with their reading scores. They began looking into it. They got a new superintendent several years ago, and they launched full bore into Science of Reading. This is the end of the second year of doing it. It was a big change for the teachers. It was a big change for the school leaders. They spent a fairly generous hunk of their federal pandemic money mm-hmm. on training and bringing in materials and such. And as I said, if you walked into a Cudahy first or second grade class now, it would be very different than what you would have seen 4 or 5 years ago. Much more scripted, much more student involvement, a lot of chanting and group exercises and reading together and so on. So far, the teachers say, you know what? There are kids who weren't reading well before who are reading much better now, and that they're really seeing results. The number of kids they have in their bottom bracket of their own scoring system has declined. It'll be, even if it's really successful, it'll be a few years until you see a major elevation of reading scores there, but they think they're making progress. They're putting a lot into it. You know, different experts would tell you different things. 40 or 50 or 70 even percent of kids will learn how to read fairly well, no matter how they're taught.
Okay.
The real subject is that other group, the 30% or 40%. And this is really aimed at raising that group that in Wisconsin testing would be called below basic. So in Cudahy, they're very gung-ho. They gave me a lot of access, which from a reporter standpoint, that's nice.
It's helpful.
Talk to teachers, talk to kids, talk to parents, certainly talk to the school leaders. So they're a really good case study in doing it in a positive way. And I bet they'll get good results over time. So far, it's early, but there's some positive scores. It's a good example of nationwide of what's happening. All these states that have been passing science of reading laws, and New York City, the largest school district in the country, of course, just declared that every school in New York is going to go to this more phonics-based approach. In most places, there's a little bit of progress. In few places, there's a dramatic progress. Mm-hmm. As I said before, Mississippi is the place everybody points to because their scores have gone up dramatically in the last 8 years, 8, 9 years. They're still kind of in the middle of the pack, but they used to be like the worst in the country. So Cudahy is a really good case study of a place doing it in a positive way and getting some early positive results.
And is it a good case study also? Because I think sometimes when you think, like I said, I went to Queen of Peace. There was 50 kids per grade. All parents were very engaged. You know, it's like, that's not a great case study, I think, because that's not always replicable in public schools and bigger schools. And so does Cudahy have a good cross-section of size of school, diversity of both class, race, to like how this could work at other districts?
Oh, I think the answer is pretty much yes. It's certainly not a really wealthy community. I mean, for whatever the reasons, and we could discuss that for the rest of the day, rich kids do better than poor kids. This is true nationwide.
Yeah.
Kids who come from homes where the parents had a lot of educational success do better than kids who come from homes where the parents were dropouts or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's just a dramatically clear statistic. Cudahy is kind of isn't, you know, one of the wealthiest communities around and doesn't have the highest college success for its parents and such. So yeah, they've got a really good cross section. Like I said, Cudahy is different. The Cudahy of today is different than the Cudahy of, oh, say, 1975 or something. So it's a good place to do a case study, but that correlation between the cards that kids have in their hands when they're born, you know, what kind of hand they're dealt, and their educational success is a really provocative question in general. And it is in terms of reading that are the kids who are in, I mean, New Berlin has gone big into science of reading. Elmbrook is going big into science of reading. And they say, we've got kids who are not such great readers. We've got kids mm-hmm. who we need to bring everybody up. They want to have 95% of their kids successful readers by several years from now. But those are really well-to-do communities by comparison. what about Cudahy, or especially what about
MPS,
dare I say, Milwaukee?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, that's a whole other topic, because we only have 30 seconds left, because I wanted to talk more about MPS and if this is a silver bullet. So we're just going to have you back so we could talk about it more. But Alan, follow Alan Borsig. Yeah, absolutely. Follow Alan Borsig on Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His writing is so great. Thank you so much for your time today. Can't wait to talk to you again. Have a great day, Alan. All right, we'll be back in just a minute with Master Cheesemakers. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
What you looking for, cheese? I'm cheddar. I'm much better than the rest of these.
Don't speak too fast. You need to get a load of this. I'm Swiss.
All right, white boy. They get the gist.
Got my holes in my body, then my boy 50 Cent. Curdled on the street. Geneva represent.
Well, Vinny and Louie, forget about the other cheeses. We're so hardcore, you got the greatest to eat us.
Well, welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And, you know, in Wisconsin, every wheel of cheese... behind every wheel of cheese, there is a proud cheesemaker, but there is a small group of elite cheesemakers passionate about pushing their education to the limit. And for them, there is one final step: becoming a certified master cheesemaker. And I wanted to know what goes into this, how similar it is to being like a sommelier at the third level, because I got to go to the cheese like world championships a couple years ago, and seeing how these guys smell and taste cheese, I was like, oh, there's a whole science, another element to this. So I am so excited to talk to our next guest, Adam Brock, who is the Vice President of Food Safety, Quality, and Regulatory Compliance at DFW and a master cheesemaker program liaison, and Mike Macheski?
Matacheski.
There we go. A master cheesemaker who now serves as a consultant at CDR. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you.
So how would you just, what is the definition of a master cheesemaker?
So we can go with the technical definition, but Mike here is a master cheesemaker. So that's all there is to say about it. But truthfully, I think Mike can probably speak to that better, because if you look big picture, and for every consumer, everybody listening, it's marrying the art and science of cheese. It's the best way of putting it.
Okay.
There's science behind it. There's art behind it. And our master cheesemakers are excellent in both. And I'd like Mike to talk a little bit about it, because I think he brings a wonderful perspective being a master cheesemaker.
So I started making cheese in 1993 as what we called a hooper.
Okay.
In Kraft, Antigo, Wisconsin. And we know Kraft for that green shaker can. We were making a part of that green shaker can. A couple of months later, Kraft decided to pull out. The employees bought the facility. And eventually, after about, I think it was in 1995, I became the second shift cheesemaker. And I apprenticed with several cheesemakers there who had like 20, 30 years of experience. And I learned how to make cheese in the Antigo facility so that I could put in my time and actually apply to become a Wisconsin cheesemaker. And again, that's a process where you have to be apprenticed for at least 6 months.
Okay.
Okay. After that, it's like, okay, I'm a licensed cheesemaker. I work many, many years, and somebody suggested to me, hey, there's this Master Cheesemaker program. Actually, Larry Steckbauer, he was in the second class. He says, well, when your time comes, which will be quite a while, it takes 10 years before you can even apply to the program.
Wow. Wow.
So you have 10 years of making cheese, learning about cheese, and then you can apply to the program. And that involves, okay, you have to have certain references and all this, you know. And you apply and to the board. And the board, at that point, Marianne Smukowski was running the Master Cheesemaker program for CDR. And she calls up, well, you've been accepted. We'll be coming up to interview you. And nobody told me what that meant.
Okay.
So there's this, I know now. But there's like a 15-page oral interview. They just put you on the spot. And it's just like, okay.
And what kind of questions? There's a 15-minute oral interview.
Define curd.
That could be one of them.
Okay.
But again, a lot of it was about, you know, really nerdy references to the different laws that regulate cheese making in Wisconsin.
Okay.
It's like, oh, okay. Or I remember one question in particular. It's like, what's the component that most limits making cheese? And I go, well, it's casein. And she goes, that's wrong. It's fat. I go, no. Without casein to trap the fat, you would have nothing. She goes, you're right. Damn it.
Victory!
So again, I was accepted into the program.
That's exactly the reason you got accepted, because you proved the interviewer wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Marianne and I are still great friends. Anyway, I was accepted into the program. So what that means now, I have 3 years of work. I have to take coursework. It's up to 8 courses that you have to take. You have to submit your cheese to prove that you are making great cheese, that you are capable of being a master cheesemaker. And again, depending on the cheese, every cheese has a standard of its own. Some cheese have federal standards. In my case, I applied for Parmesan and Asiago for my first two cheeses. You have to be making those for at least 5 years. I had more than 10. But again, my samples had to make the grade and all that fun stuff. So then after 3 years of sampling and all the coursework, oh, we're going to send you the final exam, which is an open book exam. They say, give yourself 40 hours to take it. One of the things that, you know, becoming a master takes a lot of work, but you still got to do your regular job. So yeah, like everybody, I would find myself right at the end going, oh, damn, it's due in a couple days. I better lock my office door, put a sign up, only really important stuff, please. I did pass. Later, I was encouraged and foolish enough to apply to return and be mastered in Fontina and Romano. And then towards the end of my career as an active cheesemaker, I went for Bellavitano and Pastoral Blend.
All right. So is this basically the equivalent? Can you say I have my PhD in cheese?
You can say that.
Is that like technically true?
I would say Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, and they have it on their site, right, that it's equivalent to a PhD in cheese. And you know, quite frankly, it is. One of the great things about the program, it's you think you know something when you're going into. You put in 10 years of making cheese, and it's like, quite honestly, you don't know that much.
Wow. And
it's a great, great, great program to learn, to challenge yourself. Because there's always, always, always room for improvement, always plenty more to learn. And you can, every cheese making facility, they have their way of doing it.
Okay.
But a lot of us don't understand why.
It's just like it's always been done that way. So, like, that's just how they do it.
It's always been done that way. And it's just like, okay, so then, you know, I'm a master who's asking why. And I'm also actually a person who's working in the R&D product development area, which that's my job to ask why and say, well, why do we do that? Why can't we do it that way? And that was always the fun part.
We are talking cheese in this segment with Adam Brock, who is the Vice President of Food Safety, Quality, and Regulatory Compliance at DFW and Master Cheesemaker Program Liaison, and Mike Medichewski, who is a Master Cheesemaker now serving as a consultant at CDR. Mike, do you get to charge more for your cheese now that you're a Master Cheesemaker, or do you get a special, I mean, is there a trophy?
There's a stamp that comes on your cheese.
What do you get for going through all of this?
What do I get personally for that? I get the satisfaction of being recognized, being a master.
Okay.
And I remember when I first was training as a cheesemaker, I was working with somebody who had 40 years, and he could walk in to the area where we're making cheese, and he could hear something that wasn't right.
Wow.
Michael, I want to be that one day. And just have that natural sense. And then, okay. And then I'm the type of person who also wants to push boundaries, walk off the cliff as often as I can. Somehow I'll find my way back without scraping myself too badly.
So then, Adam, How many people have gone through this program? Like, how many graduates have there been of the Master Cheesemaker program
in Wisconsin? Well, let's state that first. So it is a Wisconsin unique thing.
Yeah.
The only one in the U.S. So that's why it's so prestigious. But I think we've had about 60 to 70, somewhere in there. Some early on in the program, right? You have early on, and in comparison, if you have about 1,300 cheesemakers, you have 60 to 70 at one time.
At one time, yes.
Yeah, that have been part of the program. So we have a booklet that we produce every year, list all the cheesemakers, current master cheesemakers, their cheeses, a little bit about their company and their history. But it's a huge story. It, you know, 25, 30 years ago when this started, I don't know what that first class thought. I bet some of them thought, hey, we don't know if this is going to be around forever, but it is. And it continues to grow and we continue to recruit because consumers, now, if you talk to consumers, they want to know who's behind their food. And Wisconsin, we've got that. Mike can proudly be, as a master cheesemaker in the past, I guess now he could too, but you could take his face could be on packages. I mean,
and who wouldn't want that face on packages?
Whether I liked it or not, yeah. I became a cheese poster boy.
But it does. When you think about consumers, right? They're always asking, I want to get to the farm. I want to know who made my cheese. I want to make, you know, here you go. This is the person that did it. And here's what it took to get to that level. And I would say for Mike, you know, the cool thing is when you look at the number of people that have tried to get in, there are individuals that have been rejected. If you talk to any of the former liaisons or any of the former administrators like Marianne, I can tell you we've been in the plants and they are great cheesemakers, but they're missing a skill and they just can't get into the program. And some of them will come back after a little bit of time and say yes, or they'll talk to a former master. Like somebody might reach out to Mike and say, hey, I was declined. I didn't get in this round. What do I need to work on? And we'll tell them what they need to work on. And then they often go to a master cheesemaker and say, hey, I need to work on this area. What tools, tips, tricks can you give me? But really, it's just time. I don't know. There's no real tricks, right, Mike? It's just time.
No, there's
it's just experience.
It's definitely a matter of time. It's definitely a certain amount of book work. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of cheesemakers are not used to. I would say the bulk of cheesemakers are not college educated,
mm-hmm.
or if they are, they have a degree in something else. Me personally, my degree was in history.
Oh wow!
Graduated from Madison in history. Did lots of other things, but I had this natural gift for creating food things, and cheese is just naturally one of them. Now, I've been fortunate to be on the board, the master board, for a few years. And that was, Adam mentioned, that was one of our challenges, that we were getting applicants who were struggling. We created a few programs to help them, test them. I sat down with Mark Johnson. It's like, well, we need to give them some exercises to get their brains working outside of the daily routine. Because, and again, I've participated in the interviews on the other side now. And again, it's like a lot of them know the answers, but they're not used to being asked those questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny because I kind of said it as a joke at the beginning, but it does. I mean, it's the very little I know about becoming a sommelier, and that's largely from the documentary Somm. It sounds like that, whereas like there's some people who just don't make it to the mastery level of that, no matter how hard they study, and they just can't get past that last hump. Would you guys agree that it's kind of on a similar, I mean, it's different. You're making cheese versus tasting wine and there's some differences, but as far as like the actual mastery level of it, is that a comparable comparison?
I believe so. Again, it's a combination of art and science, but as a master of the science, you really have to understand that. And if you don't, it's like, and the other part of it, I remember taking the exam and also we were talking on the board about, you know, people that were taking exam and failing. The biggest issue that they would run into is they would just write essentially, yeah, I know what to do, not why.
And yeah, the other I know part, that part.
the other part of it is, okay, I know why, but I also have to reference where I found that information.
Absolutely.
I learned that.
Well, this is...
Yes.
We have to go. Unfortunately, we're against a break. But Adam and Matt, this was so fascinating and so interesting. We'll link the website to our show notes today. But who knew? Master Cheesemakers. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. All right. When we come back, we will wrap up today's show with a job that you might just want as a cheese and pizza taster. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Don't you? We know you don't. Wait, no.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair.
They were so interesting.
That's so interesting.
It's like the bar exam for cheese.
Well, especially it's in the same way that Adam was saying, is like there's some people who just can't get in the program.
Yeah.
And the fact that they keep trying and they want it. And what I didn't get to ask, unfortunately, is like the different career, like the career paths that come from doing it. And then, you know, what opportunities open up by doing it versus it's just the dogged nature of like, I just want this as far as the motivation to keep trying to get into the program. But it's
just all the experience you have to put in before you can even apply for that master cheesemaker status. It's astonishing.
Well, to be fair, though, if you do like cheese, but you don't think you're going to become a master cheesemaker anytime soon, and you just want to be a cheese and pizza taster.
I'd be good at this.
Well, if you have time for another part-time job, Jane, UW-Madison has the job for you.
Really?
I feel like these pop up every once in a while where you're like, this is like the most Wisconsin job ever, but this, maybe. So it involves getting paid to taste copious amounts of cheese, pizza, and other dairy products.
Okay.
So the Center for Dairy Research, which is the same program, that's where the Master Cheese program is a part of, is the Center for Dairy Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They're looking to hire people passionate about all types of food, but especially cheese, pizza, and dairy products. Those hired will be trained to become part of a group of expert tasters capable of verbally describing their sensory experience on the basis of appearance, texture, taste, and aroma attributes for research and product development purposes.
Wow.
Their title? Take a guess what you think the title is. This is literally the title on the job posting.
Cheese taster.
No.
More complicated.
It's more complicated than cheese taster.
I don't
know. It's fancier.
I
would love to see this on someone's resume at some point.
Purveyor of fine cheeses and dairy products. I have no idea.
It's better. That's closer.
Is it better?
Descriptive sensory panelist.
Oh, I love that.
Descriptive sensory panelist. That is the job posting. And I just think it's so funny. So basically, what can you expect to be doing? Up to 24 cheese samples and 12 pizzas is what you'll be tasting.
Okay.
And it is a job. So your responsibilities include, where is it? Responsible for describing a range of food products in terms of appearance, texture, and aroma and flavor. Actively participate and collaborate in descriptive panel discussions. Responsible for completely and accurately entering own scoring data. Responsible for accurately following instructions on the scene. None of these responsibilities seem that
egregious.
Yeah, no, like they seem too doable. Attend and participate fully in all training discussions. Actively participate in panelist performance monitoring studies, biannual taste acuity rescreening, and subsequent retraining. It sounds so fancy. It sounds so much more professional than just like, we need you to eat this and
cheese.
Tell us how you think it tastes.
In the most descriptive way possible.
And so if you would like, if you're looking, I don't know how much it pays. Let's see. Does it say at the bottom? $15 hourly. Not bad.
That is not a terrible thing.
Not bad. 15. I mean, there's that's more than childcare workers are making right now.
Right?
Jeez. Which is a terrible thing to say.
I know. Oh, I know.
So if you're interested in this.
If you're a foodie, boy, this would be a great thing.
I don't know if you have to live. Scheduled hours will vary. Panelists will need to be available for three hour consecutive periods, which is one session, and up to three sessions per week. So probably, unless you're willing to drive.
To commute.
But this is in Madison. And so I will link it if any of you are interested in doing this and have some free time or want to make some extra cash.
Don't let this opportunity pass you by.
That is really funny.
What experience
do you think they're looking for?
I think it's going to be about words. And I think it's going to be about your vocabulary, certainly. How descriptive can you be? It's slightly nutty. It has a smooth finish. It's got, you can tell the age by the crystallization of the rind. I don't know.
But it doesn't say anything about experience. Because like everything you're describing is kind of what we're talking about with the master sommelier and master cheesemakers. And that's what I experienced when I went to the World Championship of Cheese. And I saw them. Literally, you know, they come out with the submissions are like big wheels of cheese and they do a corkscrew type thing.
Right.
And the wedge that they pull out and they're sniffing the rind. They're sniffing the actual part. They're like wiping it to see the consistency before they even taste it.
Mm-hmm.
But that all seems to take training to know how to do that. And maybe they'll get that kind of training, but like, this is not asking for any kind of, this is like basically, I think just asking for lay people. So what, like of the submissions they get, how do you stand out? Because this is where my ADHD brain's going to be like, well, we're just going to do this after the show.
We're going
to apply see what the questions are. And I will report back tomorrow to see how thorough and how many different questions of like, the first barrier to entry, if it's just like getting people in the door, or if there's like, do you have any experience with any kind of tasting, or like, have you ever been a judge on any kind of panel to...
Maybe they really are just looking for lay people, though, who are...
Foodies,
who are interested in helping develop some new products.
Maybe.
Or test out some new products.
I don't know.
Let's put cheese on this.
It's piqued my curiosity, so I'm going to investigate this after the show.
I like that idea.
But that'll about do it for us today. Thank you for texting. Thank you for calling, especially in the first hour. We got a lot of calls in the first hour, which was super fun to hear from you, as it always is. But that'll do it. We'll be back tomorrow with another full day. So come back then, 10 a.m., 10 to 2, 10 to 12.
10 to 12. It's only week two.
It's only week two. Grant me some grace.
We're getting
All right. This has been As Goes Wisconsin. We'll see you tomorrow.
He looked at me and said, I don't want that bread. The only thing I want is
macaroni and cheese.
Threw the bread away, wouldn't touch it. That's the way it is with some kids today. Not me, man. When I was growing up, I ate everything that was put in front of me. Absolutely everything. My parents would put a tire in front of me. I would eat it up. My parents would... drive you crazy. I said, you know, you grow up, you know what you're gonna look like. You are what you mean. You're gonna look like one big piece of macaroni. Who's gonna talk to you walking down the street? They're just gonna run away from you. Say, there's a kid that looks like a piece of macaroni. What's with that? That's true. No, it could happen to you. You spend your whole life eating macaroni and cheese. Who knows what's gonna happen to you? That kid doesn't care at all. He just looks at me and he says,
macaroni.
Yeah, macaroni.
Cheese.